Blog Talk Radio.
Well, good afternoon, everyone, and thank you for joining us today on Gold Radio Cafe. It's Friday, July 27th, 2012, and welcome to the Gold and Silver Financial Review. My name is Bosco Kocharovich, and this program is brought to you by Central Metals Corp. We understand the problem, and we have the answer. Gold and silver-related investments. Our website is centralmetalscorp.com, and our phone number is 519-915-7542. Our email address is mail@centralmetalscorp.com. We will be accepting email questions during the program, so if you could just direct those to our email box, we'd be happy to address those questions. We have a lot of information to discuss today. First, we'll start with a couple of quotes here. Both gold and silver seem to be breaking out of some significant resistance levels. We got gold at 1618.75 and silver at 2752. Silver's high today, by the way, was 2785, so it's come down off the highs, but we're still over that $27 area, and like we discussed on this program last week, I mentioned that the bottom is possibly forming, and this could be the breakout that we were looking for. Not that we do trading here, but, it just seems that the trend is going up, and fundamentally speaking, gold and silver are the assets of last resort. And with that, we'd like to bring in our guest, Jeff Dunphy, to discuss some of the important developments going on around the world. Jeff, welcome to the program.
Good afternoon, Bosco. How are you?
Good. How are you?
I'm terrific. Boy, there's lots in the news right now, isn't there?
Yes, we have some big comments by some significant bankers recently. Would you like to start off with that?
Yeah, absolutely. Let's chat a little about the preservation of the euro. Mario Draghi came out yesterday in the last little bit and said, we will do anything it takes and everything it takes to preserve the euro, which means in layman talk or layman parlance, it means that they will print money in order to prevent the decline. And the markets jumped. They all got really excited with this because the markets are fraught with that. Let's bounce up and around. And it also talks about the printing of fiat money that creates this delusion of prosperity. The other thing that happened yesterday was that Sandy Weill, who used to run Citicorp, and in fact was right in bed with the federal regulators in terms of dismissing the Glass-Steagall Act, he came out and said it's time to split the banks up. So now we have the bankers and the feds and the powers that be, those who can print money, all going, oh my goodness gracious me, how in blazes are we going to keep this from collapsing? And as you and I spoke of some time ago, Bosco, this is like a man jumping off a cliff that's a very high cliff, and he can't see the horizon reaching him, and he's flapping his wings, deluded into thinking that he is flying. And all of a sudden, as the ground gets closer and closer, he starts to flap his arms faster and faster for fear that his flying delusion needs to have more impetus put to it. This is what's happening with the printing of money. So now I want to chat a little about some history about the creation of the Federal Reserve and this whole thing, because it lends itself to some historic facts and figures that presented themselves back in the early days when the Federal Reserve was created. However, prior to me starting that story, I want to bounce it back to Bosco for a moment, merely because these two things mean wonderful things for gold and silver. And the manipulation of the market and all that nonsense, there's also increased scrutiny under and around the banks, the whole context of, my goodness, there looks like some serious manipulation happening as well. and how they may go at it. And Bosco, you know, needless to say, when there's scrutiny and when there's potential lawsuits going on about the banks have to be very mindful about how they manipulate the market. What do you think about that?
Well, yeah, there's obvious manipulation going on. I mean, the price of gold and silver where they are right now is just, it doesn't really make sense. And one of the things that I wanted to discuss, Jeff, was, you know, with the introduction now of these developments, we've had, as we discussed on the show previously, the Bank of International Settlements was commenting about using gold, that gold would qualify as a Tier 1 asset for collateral. And then I believe last week the FDIC in the U.S. said that gold is a 0% risk-free asset. Well, when people are saving, putting money away for savings, and eventually when you retire, your main cost of living is food and energy. And as we discussed last week, I believe, food and energy prices are not included in the inflation.
CPI. Rate,
the CPI, yeah. That's right. So you picture a retired individual. He spent his life working and putting money away, and he thinks he's safe because he has a GIC, for example, which is returning right now maybe 1%. Okay, when inflation rate is 2%, you're losing money guaranteed. The thing that they don't guarantee is that the price of food and energy in retirement is going to stay the same. So your savings essentially are being evaporated, or what do they call it? It's a hidden tax.
The invisible tax.
Yes, that's it. So
the invisible tax, the devaluation of a currency, yeah.
Exactly. So one of the services that we provide here is the U-Vault account, where clients could essentially put their savings into gold and silver and have it stored away, and it's 100% fully insured by Lloyd's of London, okay, which has been around since the 1700s, I believe, even before.
Maybe even older than that, yeah.
Yeah. So... But here, the big difference is FDIC and CDIC insurance only, depending on where. I think in the U.S. it's now $200,000. In Canada, I believe it's still only $100,000. Where if you put gold and silver away, you put $1 million or $100 million, Lloyd's is going to insure the full value of it. So it's a great way for people to put their savings away. It's one of the products we offer, and if anyone wants information, they could just give us a call, and we could send you on that. But aside from that, you know, I'd like to discuss more what's really happening, because these are big changes that we're talking about. If they reinstate Glass-Steagall and break up the banks, I'm trying to figure out, how does gold fit into that picture? You know, about it, but they didn't really mention, you know, exactly how they're going to include gold. I believe it has to be included somehow, but...
Well, let me dive in, Bosco, in these notes that I've been writing for our listeners, okay? Let me dive into this, and let me also preface what we're going to chat about a little by my skepticism about what is, in fact, going on. Now, Sandy Weill came out and said, let's split the banks up, and he was... You know, this is not lost on us that it's ironic that he was responsible for the dismissal of the Glass-Steagall Act. In fact, while he was accumulating companies, he was in with the Fed and the Treasury trying to get rid of it, even before legislation was passed to dismiss it. So he is coming out saying, let's get rid of the Glass-Steagall. So now I want to do some history, and I want to talk about the devaluation of a currency. Okay. Now, the Federal Reserve was created when Woodrow Wilson was in power in 1913. Now, a little prior to that, in 1910, a bunch of the bankers got together and said, how is it that we can organize a banking system where we can't lose and where we will create a monetary system? This is called the fractional reserve system. How can we create a monetary system where we can print money, backstop it with gold, because it was done at the time, backstopped by gold. And how is it that we can organize a wee bit of a cartel to further our own interests, protect ourselves from the downside, and also eliminate some of the other wannabe banks, some of the small banks? Because prior to 1910, the banking industry had had a bit of a go. So this is what was presented in the early 10s and 12s, it was presented and organized and created so that in 1913 it passed. Now, Paul Warburg at the time, the Americans had an incredibly strong, diligent embrace of don't tell us what to do and don't manipulate us. So in the Act of 1913, Paul Warburg, the guys that put this all together, Paul Warburg was one of them, but really probably the designer of the Federal Reserve Act, he put teeth in there that worried the rest of the bankers. He said, oh, man, I don't know. There's some teeth in here, but they can come back and hurt us. And Paul Warburg said, no, don't worry. We'll just get the law passed. We'll change the teeth later, okay, which smacks of what I think Sandy Weill is presenting, and that is let's browbeat the banks, let's organize things, and they're all getting together saying we have to do this to make justice seem to be done. So this is what happened in 1913. So now let's chat a little about the purchasing power, which we talked about relative to our conversation about gold and silver. So from 1913 to 1933, the purchasing power of the U.S. dollar fell by 30%. 30%. Okay, so now let's put that in perspective of a dollar in 1913 buys what a dollar 31 buys in 1930. Okay, so that's a 30% decline in 30 years. So now, there was an Emergency Bank Relief Act of 1933, and this is when good old President Roosevelt came out. This was after the Depression, which is what we're in the middle of right now, in a sense. President Roosevelt came out and said, we are confiscating all the gold you own at $20 an ounce. Shortly thereafter, they revalued the dollar relative to gold at $35 an ounce. So we're going to take it all away from you. We're going to devalue the dollar and reissue it at $35 an ounce. That didn't work for the general population because it was a massive devaluation. So now let's chat about what happened to the dollar from 1933 to 1971. A dollar in 1933, after the devaluation, has the same buying power as $3.12 in 1971. So that's a 60% decline in 38 years. You get where this is going, right?
Yep.
So now all of a sudden, in 71, the late 60s, early 70s, they were spending money hand over fist on military spending. And so all of the creditors, all of the people who owned U.S. bonds went, can you actually backstop this by gold? And the Americans went, well, and then they went to Nixon and went, yeah, we got to get rid of the gold standard because we can't print money enough to pay for the military industrial complex, which good old Ike had made mention of.
Yep.
Okay, so now let's chat a little about the next little bit. So that was when the U.S. dollar went off the gold currency in 1971, and that was called the Bretton Woods Agreement. That's when Nixon closed the relationship on gold. So now, from 1971 to almost now, to 2010, so 2 years ago, guess how much purchasing power we've lost in the last 40 years, from 71 to now? 83%. That's the purchasing power lost from 1971 to now. So a dollar then bought the same as $5.38 buys now. Okay, so now, okay, let's talk about purchasing power and let's try to make it relatively simple. That's like you buying a stock, an XYZ stock, at $100 in 1971, and it's now worth $17. So you've lost 83% of your value. Ouch, that hurts.
Yep.
So in order for you to get back even, the stock that's now trading at 7 has to go up by almost 6 times. Okay?
Yep.
So guess what? This is the loss of purchasing power. And this, ladies and gentlemen, is what Bosco and I are trying to expose relative to this. And this is what the regulators and the rulemakers are terrified about relative to what is going on. They are flapping their wings. Mario Draghi is saying, we will do whatever we need to do to support the euro. And the banks are starting to say, how can we make justice seem to be done? Which brings me to another little quote from a guy named Rick Rule, who works with the Sprott organization that we listened to recently, Bosco and I.
Yep.
And he says, we now have fiat currency, which is valueless in our perspective. Everybody agrees that it's got some value, or they're pretending to agree that it has some value. But Rick coined a phrase which is quite funny, and it's the U.S. dollar, which is an I owe you nothing, and the euro, which is a who owes you nothing. Who is paying for the euro? And the Americans won't be paying for their dollar. So this also brings us back into what Bosco and I have been chatting with you about for some time, and that is the devaluation of a currency that is an invisible tax that creates a banking system where all the wealth is channeled away and funneled away from those who actually create it to those who actually confiscate it. Color me skeptical, but these numbers don't lie because they come right from the government.
No, Jeff, I want to... Yeah, no, I want to congratulate you that you connected the dots perfectly. I think a lot of people need to understand, what you discussed exactly explains to people where money comes from and who's really in control of the value of your money. Value, when related to your cost of living or your purchasing power, people need to know that there's third parties involved that are in control of that value. One thing that, that I get a lot of questions about is the confiscation issue. And I wanted to get your thoughts on that. It seems to me exactly what you explained, that we're, in a sense, repeating history, what happened in the 1930s when they introduced Glass-Steagall, okay? And what happened shortly after they introduced Glass-Steagall was that they issued a confiscation law. Back then, there was a large number of people that actually held gold coins. Gold was a circulating currency, if you will. And I know for a fact that a very small percentage of the people actually turned in their gold. Now, people ask me all the time, they're worried about investing in gold because of confiscation. One of the main differences is back then when the confiscation law was introduced, the U.S. dollar was still backed by gold. So they needed the gold to support the military spending. Okay. Now, fast forward to today, we have zero gold standard. We have huge military spending, and gold is still going up in value. Now, if people start putting their savings in gold, what are the chances of confiscation? Well, if we follow the pattern of what happened in the 30s, now, if we restore the Glass-Steagall Act, the chances of them creating a law to confiscate gold, well, they don't need to because now we still have the Federal Reserve System. They can print the money that they need. Why would they need to confiscate the gold? That's one argument. The other argument is, well, how hard would it be to go around to all the people that own gold, it's very simple to hide. You can dig it in your backyard, and they know that. I mean, would they even bother going knocking on people's door? Probably not. And another thing is, back then gold was very prominent in people's minds. Now, research reports reveal that less than 1% of the investable assets around the world are in gold and silver related assets. When in, I believe, in the early 80s, it was around 26%, the last time that gold reached its peak. So I'm just trying to figure out, you know, nobody really knows what they're going to do, but I believe that gold has to be introduced into the monetary system in some fashion. I don't believe that it's going to be used as a circulating currency now, but what do you think about the confiscation? Does that make sense? Would it even make sense for them to confiscate?
Well, I mean, the pragmatics in confiscating gold right now is very simple, and that is when if you and I got together, how could we touch a bunch of the gold in the system? We'd just go to the big holders of gold. And consequently, the retail investor, if you will, the little guy who has been skewered relative to the big guys, the large institutions, they are so small that the pragmatics is, why would you spend a whole bunch of time and energy to confiscate their gold when you can probably touch 80 or 90% of the gold by going to the enormous institutions or the governments and touching it there? So I think pragmatically the risk of confiscation is relatively low. Mm-hmm. And so that's valid. And I want to reiterate, the reinstitution of Glass-Steagall is a bit of a mea culpa of the banking institution saying, well, maybe we just got a little carried away. But in my opinion, it's more a reaction to how to band-aid this situation over so that they can reestablish control over all of the fiat money. Now, I want to put a couple of fiscal or a couple of financial notes in hand here, okay? Over the last 40 years or 42 years, let's say, in 1970, household median income between 1970 and, say, 08 or 09, it increased by about 30%. We now get into, how much do you think federal spending increased? How about almost 10 times that? Federal spending increased 242%. So what's happening, Bosco, as we've said often, is the governments are borrowing to keep themselves in power. And these are their own numbers. They're borrowing to keep themselves in power and borrowing to spend and spend and spend. And they're printing this fiat currency. There is a reason why the price of gold has gone up a whole bunch in this last little bit. So what they're doing is they're trying to keep an old, broken down, antiquated, skewered, gamed system. They're trying to keep it in place. They're flapping as they're plummeting to the ground. And they're trying to appease everybody's concern because the lights are starting to go on. When people listen to what we have to say, it makes them think about what's going on. They're trying to appease a marketplace that says, you guys are a bunch of crooks. And consequently, they're getting together all cleverly going, how can we make it look as if we're doing something in order to fix this? When they're all in collusion and have been for decades organizing the deregulation so they can confiscate through invisible tax, and confiscate by skewing the wealth from the savers and the diligent workers to the wealth of the spenders and the borrowers, okay? We've got a currency crisis at hand. Everybody knows about it. And what the Europeans have just said is, we will spend our way out of this. We will borrow our way out of our borrowing crisis. What lunacy, okay? What lunacy. That's like telling your 18-year-old kid who has a $2,000 credit card and having the bank call you up as a parent saying, well, you co-signed and it's $2,000. The parent saying, oh, well, just increase his credit limit to $3,000. That'll show him.
Yeah.
Just
it's, like, right? It's a kid in a candy store. You give the politicians the right to print money. What do you think they're going to do? They're going to print money. I mean, it's the easiest solution for them to stay in office. And one of the another important, this week, I don't know, in the past few days, a lot of huge developments. We got what we discussed with the reintroduction of Glass-Steagall and the Sandy Weill. And we also have Ron Paul's bill to audit the Fed got passed yesterday in the House. So
yeah, that's big.
This could be the start of some major changes, and I'm wondering if there's any relation to it. Maybe it's just a coincidence that, you know, this bill being passed kind of lit the fuse for Sandy Weill to make those comments that maybe we should reinstate Glass-Steagall and break up the bank. So I think there's going to be some major changes. And, you know, a lot of people talk about fear-mongering and you know, all that there's too big to fail. I really don't agree with that. I think human nature is creative, and we'll figure a way out of this. The people that are going to fail and who are really behind these money printing schemes are the banks and the big financial industries. They're the ones who are going to lose their big $100 million bonuses and so on. Of course, they want to protect the system that's feeding them millions and millions of dollars, while the average citizen and the middle class is being destroyed. So I think the big institutions, yeah, they're going to fail, and who cares? As long as we can bring some type of stability back into our manufacturing and production and natural resources. And with that, Jeff, I know that we discussed earlier, we had a big development in Canada in the energy market. Do you have any comments on that?
I do, and I'll get to that in a brief moment, because I want to address what you've just pointed out, and that is we have the big banks going on. We have the financial institutions gaming the system. But the other thing that I cannot overestimate enough is this. The financial institutions and the governments that regulate them are in bed together. So even though Ron Paul's passing of a law is wonderful, and it's a fabulous act, and it's a very progressive step pushing things towards transparency, one of the challenges that he will face even after the law has been passed is his capacity to expose the egregious behavior between the government and the large financial institutions, because they are so cross-pollinated that they become one in and of themselves. So when Greece went into their financial calamity with no election, they just installed a prime minister in Greece that just happened to be an old Goldman Sachs guy. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, they're organizing and managing things that looks a bit incestuous, Bosco, and we need to be mindful of that. So Ron Paul, I genuinely believe, is a wonderful crusader for the transparency of stuff, and the auditing of this auditing bill will be fabulous if it's carried out in the spirit in which it's instigated. If it isn't,
right,
then it will be what we call obfuscated. It'll be just sort of thrown awry, and nothing will happen, because they will, you know, they will bash people about the knuckles with a Nerf bat and send them on their way, which is what they have done with the LIBOR scandal. They've said, here's your millions of dollars, go away, you irresponsible CFO, rather than putting him in jail. So now let's chat a little about what is happening with large capital in the world and how people are utilizing it to deploy in order to think of and provide some semblance of safety for themselves. Now, the Chinese are owed by the U.S. government anywhere from $1 to $1.3 trillion, which means they all own a bunch of bonds, T-bonds that the U.S. Treasury has issued. The whole time they're going, boys, when you print money, these bonds that you owe us become less and less and less and less valuable. And they have taken the U.S. to task by saying, stop printing money, which is an impossibility. That's how they're choosing to get their way out of this pickle, and that is inflate their way out of it. In the same breath, they're looking around internally, and Bosco, they're looking and they're chatting and they're saying, how in flipping blazes are we going to deploy the U.S. dollars that we own to buy something of value? And what they're doing is they're saying, we need hydrocarbons, let's go buy them. So when they went into the States and they tried to buy Chevron, the Americans went, no, we're not going to let you. In the last little bit, the Koreans, the Malaysians, the Chinese, Sinopec, and also CNOOC have come into Canada and bought enormous companies, spent billions of dollars. In this latest scenario, Nexen had a bid on the table for $15 billion.
Wow.
This can be viewed in all kinds of ways, but in fact, the Chinese are saying our U.S. dollars are going to be worth far less in a really short period of time because the U.S. is trying to print its way out of its trouble. And back to the FDIC, if the federal government says happy to guarantee your $100,000 worth of paper, who cares? We're going to print our way out of this anyway. So your $100,000 worth of paper is going to be worth $20,000 soon. Whereas when Lloyd's of London says, I'll guarantee you $1 million worth of gold, they're guaranteeing your gold, right? An interesting departure in terms of perspective on guarantees. So, yeah, the Chinese are coming in and spending money in North America as fast as they can because they see the value of their dollars diminishing quite rapidly. And it's not in their control.
Right.
So, yeah, it is an enormous amount of food for thought.
Well, yeah, I mean, the Chinese, I think, Jim Rogers is famous for talking about this years ago, that China is the next great empire of the world, and it's obvious that it is happening. Regarding the gold and the FDIC, I mean, you know, gold as a reserve, central banks have gold in reserve, and We like to tell people, you know, you can essentially become your own central bank. You have a gold reserve, you put it in the vault, it's fully insured, and you let the government print whatever money they want. You know that your cost of living is safe. Gold is insurance. It's not. I always tell people it's not really an investment because everyone knows it doesn't produce interest or dividends. But when you understand the value of money, interest and dividends really don't mean much if they don't keep pace with inflation. So
yeah.
For long-term investment and retirement, you want something, a store of value. You want something that is going to compete with the cost of living, food and energy and in some cases other things. I don't want to mention real estate or the automotive industry, but when you're retired, food and energy is what most people are concerned about. Now, I'd like to just kind of, in conclusion here, I constantly hear people say that gold has no intrinsic value. And I heard it again this week from someone who should know better. I don't know why not. But people, I think, are illusioned to the fact that gold has no intrinsic value when they consider financial assets. And one of the perfect stories that I heard was from an old Humphrey Bogart movie. And it goes like this, that if 1,000 miners go into the mountain searching for gold for 6 months, one out of those 1,000 miners is going to find gold. So what does that gold find represent? It doesn't represent one man's labor for 6 months going hungry and thirsty searching for gold. It represents the 999 other men who were searching for gold for 6 months and didn't find anything. So that gold represents the labor of the individual going to find it, okay? So when you tell a miner or someone that spent their life and hard-earned money going to search for gold or whatever, you tell them that gold has no intrinsic value, I mean, I think he's going to be pretty upset. So, and one of the other things is that we have commodities, we have oil, we have wheat, corn, soybeans, sugar, coffee, and so on. All of those things can be consumed. Even silver, to a degree, is a consumable because once it goes into electronics, the computer or whatever is thrown out, it's pretty much gone. There's very few people that are going to go and recycle it. So gold is the only really commodity that can perform as money because it can't be consumed, it can't be destroyed, it's too expensive to use in consumer goods. This is why it's not. So even J.P. Morgan, I think, that you mentioned on this show, he's famous for saying gold is money, everything else is credit, and period.
Exactly.
That's the end of it. And, you know, until I think that the financial industry has been taught or brainwashed, I don't know, but to believe that gold has no intrinsic value, when in fact gold is the essence of intrinsic value because it's the only material that when you're harder, your labor and energy that goes into it, it's locked in there. It can't be consumed. It can't be wasted away. So it performs as the perfect store of value. And, you know, if I'm wrong, please, if somebody knows something better, please send me an email and let me know, because I'll put my money in it. And up until now, I really don't see anything else that can be a perfect store of value. You know, there's other places to put your money and speculate. You know, I'm all for capitalism and investing in companies and stocks and so on, provided that the balance sheets are sound and so on. But in times like these, you want safety. And unfortunately, I don't see anything in history, as you explained to us today with the Federal Reserve and what happened in the 30s, gold is the only thing that can really store value. And until people realize this, I think we're going to have these drastic changes. And
let me give you some other financial optics to this, Bosco. And it, I mean, what you say has great validity, and the whole miners scenario is also very valid. But let's also chat a little about, let's pretend we can go back to 1971. Let's pretend we're there and we're going, oh my goodness gracious, you're taking us off the gold standard. Let's buy $10,000 worth of gold in 1971.
Mm-hmm.
Let's also do an experiment. So in 1971, let's put $10,000 worth of cash in a bank, and let's just pretend we get 3% rate of return. So $10,000 worth of money in the bank in 1971 is worth $32,000 today. Not bad. Now let's go aside to the other place of where gold, which we believe is an excellent store of value, what would $10,000 worth of gold be worth right now if we bought it in 1971? And right now, $10,000 worth of gold purchased in 71 when Nixon at the Bretton Woods took us off the gold standard is worth $400,000 or more today. How can you argue with that aspect relative to gold is an excellent store of value? Now, let's chat also a little about the last couple of hundred years. In the mid-1800s, 1864 to 1879, gold declined in value. And between 1980 and 2000, gold declined in value. That's three decades in the last 200 years where the price of gold declined. Every other decade or every other time in history, gold has appreciated. Color me curious. Color me predisposed to think, I can't think of anything of a better source of store of value. And the financial industry doesn't want you to think gold is a good store of value because it knows gold is a good store of value. And as soon as you start to discover that, you're going to leave the financial instruments that the financial community is based on.
Yep.
So, you know, color me curious, Bosco, but I think we're on the right track and happy to introduce or entertain anybody who has a contrary opinion, because
yeah.
I don't know. There is we believe that gold is an excellent store of value, and we'd be hard pressed to be convinced otherwise.
Yeah, no, I invite anybody to come into my office. Just give me a call and book an appointment, and I'll be happy to discuss it with you. Jeff, would you like to give out your email address if anyone wants to send comments or questions over to you?
Absolutely. You can reach me at viadao@gmail.com. That's viatao@gmail.com. Happy to entertain your comments and your observations and your perspectives.
Okay, thank you, Jeff. We'll have a link to Jeff's email on our website at centralmetalscorp.com underneath this interview. So anyone that you know wants to make some comments or ask Jeff some questions, you can do it there. With that, Jeff, I'd like to thank you for joining us this week. It's been quite an eventful week, and look forward to seeing you again next week.
And before we go, Bosco, I'd like to leave a quote by one of the Rothschilds, who you and I've chatted about previously, and how they very cannily organized something, a financial transaction that made them £1 million in yet a day. But this is from Amschel Rothschild many, many years ago. It says, "Give me control of a nation's money, and I care not who makes her laws." We want to leave everybody knowing that those who control the money, irrespective of the political powers in hand, they are the ones who have the control over things. When you own gold, they have no control over you, merely because there's no counterparty risk on holding gold. And with that, Bosco, I look forward to chatting with you next week. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for allowing us to be of service and chatting with you about the calamity and also the safety of our predispositions.
Okay, thank you, Jeff. Have a good weekend.
You too, Bosco. Cheers.